So glad you could join us for our traditional holiday bird watching show. Hi, this is Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Bill Volkart and Tom Schultz are back with us. Bill is a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked at the Horicon Marsh for 27 years, has been watching birds for well over 40 years. Tom is a bird artist and illustrator and has illustrated a number of field guides, including several editions of the National Geographic's Field Guide to the Birds of North America. What birds are you seeing in your area? Well, we'd like to hear from you, so give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to see your bird photos. In fact, I think we have a few of them up right now, so we'll probably get to those very soon. But Bill, thank you so much for coming in again.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
You bet. And Tom, it's nice to see you in the studio.
Good morning, Jill. Nice to be here.
So this time of year, are we still seeing birds sitting on nests? What's going on with that?
Well, this is a transition time. I always think of April and May as the migration. The birds are arriving and passing through. June is when our local birds are really settling in for nesting. Obviously, some are nesting much earlier in the year. And for the general trend, I think July is sort of that fledging period. It's a time when the young are coming out of the nest and becoming independent. So that's, I guess, would cover most birds. There are some that will have later nestings or even a second nesting.
Okay,
so
yeah,
there's always a chance
that.
For that. Yeah.
Yeah, so some birds do nest more than once.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what some of the ones that we would recognize?
Well, there's a number of songbirds that will have second broods. Mourning doves are certainly a common one. Robins, they certainly start early enough and have plenty of time. Occasionally, some of the other songbirds, particularly the I would think the more robust older birds that have experience and have got good energy reserves are able to pull off a family and realize there's still enough time to try to raise a second one. But for an awful lot of our birds, it's one chance for the year, and that's about it.
One and done.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we get a lot of people that call in every time we talk about birds, and they say, I found this bird on the ground. What should I do with it? How can you tell if it's in trouble or if it's not? I mean, what's the... Well, Tom, why don't you go ahead and answer that one?
Typically, it's a pretty good idea just to leave any young bird like that alone. Chances are the parents are somewhere probably finding food, and they know perfectly well where that youngster is, and mm-hmm. they're keeping an eye on it. And, you know, usually the young ones have some distinctive calls that they're giving as location for the parents, but the parents will track them down. Sometimes, if you want, you could probably just take that young bird that might be on the ground and put it up on a branch so it's a little bit safer.
Okay.
But for the most part, you can just leave them alone.
Okay. So it's okay to touch them. It's not...
Yeah, birds really have a very poor sense of smell. Most birds do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that doesn't affect their parents like it would, say, for mammals.
Okay. Yeah, I know that's a problem. So.
Yeah, it is actually kind of a myth that if you touch a bird, the parents will abandon the nest. I've always thought it's probably a good myth, especially for kids, because if you should discover a nest, I think there's that curiosity. They keep going back. They keep a watch on it. And just like finding a young bird on the ground, your presence is keeping the parents away.
Right.
And so they may abandon it just because you're spending too much time around the nest itself uh-huh. and interfering with the raising of the young. But as Tom says, yeah, leave them alone. The parents are probably nearby. And I should also mention that if you do have something that's injured, oftentimes trying to catch a wild bird that has a fear and may already be injured, you may injure it further. So you may want to call a professional.
Okay.
And the other caveat to that is that federal laws actually prohibits people without licenses from capturing wild animals. So you can perhaps capture it long enough to, you know, out of goodwill to transport it mm-hmm. to a licensed rehabilitator. But you certainly can't keep it in your house, take care of it yourself. That's against the federal laws.
Okay, good to know. And you're talking about calls earlier, and one of my favorite calls is the sandhill crane. So let's hear a little bit of that. I just love those, and it's always the first sign of spring when I hear them. I saw some sandhill cranes the other day with three babies. Is that kind of unusual?
That's very unusual.
Yeah, very much.
That's what I thought, because it's usually two or one, right?
Yeah.
They usually lay two eggs, and one or two of those may survive.
Okay.
Yeah, three is very unusual.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. But they were small, so.
Interesting.
Yeah, unless they were, you know, babysitting. Maybe that was what was going on.
It's also interesting to note that the crane call that you just played is actually both individuals of the pair, the male and the female.
Okay.
It's what's called a unison call, and it's given by a pair that are on their territory typically.
Okay.
And so the male does the lower notes and the female chimes in with the higher notes, and it all sounds like one bird calling.
It's harmony. I like
exactly.
that. Well, let's go to the phones because I know we have lots of people that want to talk to you. First up, we have Richard in Huntley, Illinois. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
What's your question?
My question is I have a 2 acre plus prairie that I put in long ago, but it's starting to get invaded with cow parsnip and thistle, and those are just coming into flower, and I really want to cut them soon. But and it's late, it's early July, and I know I've got a lot of species around, but should I wait a little bit or before I just maybe disturb some nesting areas?
Good question. You've got a little bit of a challenge between not wanting to cut too soon, but also not wanting to wait too long before all of these invasives go to seed. For grassland management, the general rule of thumb is to wait at least till July 1st, and if possible, to July 15th. That period in June and even into early July for some later nesting birds is a time when they may be vulnerable. Wait as long as you can, but not until those seeds ripen on you. So if right now we're in early July, I would say the vast majority of birds are probably fledging their young. There is a chance that you may have some still in the nest, but general rule of thumb, at least July 1st and July 15th if you can.
So mid-July.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck with that, Richard. Thank you for the call. Marty in Douglas County, what question do you have for us today?
Hi, good morning. We've had bluebird boxes for about 25 years, and every year we do, when we notice that there are babies in the boxes, because we see the adults feeding them, we always open up the box and lift up the nest, make sure there isn't anything awful under there. We have been able to scoop larvae out that we think would be destructive. Last year we did this, and we opened up the box, and it looks like the babies had just been born, practically. I mean, they were all head, you know, and I lifted up the nest, and there was a hole in the nest, and they fell through the nest, and so we're scooping and trying to get them all back in there, and everything was fine, but it got us a little twitchy now about checking the boxes. How soon after we notice that there is activity in the box, should we wait before we actually check the nest? 4 or 5 days? Any idea about that?
Tom, what do you think?
In my experience, it's usually not a big problem to take a peek at inside the nest box. At any age, I tend to worry more about later on when they're just about ready to fledge. Sometimes if you open the box, they will suddenly explode out of the nest maybe a day or two before they're quite ready and probably can't fly that well. But usually early on, it's not a big problem to look in at their eggs and check the young nestlings.
Okay, well, thanks for that call, Marty. That would have been an interesting video to watch you putting those birds back in the box. We had Thomas on Facebook had something for us. He said every so often they get a year that is exceptional for dixisals. Did I say that right, guys?
Mm-hmm.
And 2017 has proven to be one of those. The species has been reported in very good numbers across nearly the entire state of Wisconsin. They like meadows and hayfields and have a loud and distinctive song that, with a little imagination, sounds much like their name. Do you guys want to comment on that?
Well, that was actually my post from yesterday.
Oh, that's funny. I'm like, wow, what a coincidence.
Yeah. But it brings up the point that this is a very big year for dixisals in Wisconsin. This is an eruptive species that usually every year it comes at least into southern Wisconsin and nests in meadows and hay fields. But this year, they're being found all the way up into northern Wisconsin. Of course, there's not nearly as much habitat in northern Wisconsin in the way of grasslands, but there are many records this year all the way up in the northern part of the state. And so it's a very good year. If you're interested in going out to look for dick thistles, chances are pretty good of finding them. They're on many, many roads in rural areas.
And there you have a video posted. So if anybody wants to see what that bird looks like, they can just go to our Facebook page. And we're going to go back to the phones. If you've got a question, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. And we do have open lines. We're going to go to Jerry in Shell Lake. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, good morning. I'm actually calling about red wings, but I had six bluebird chicks in a nest, and then 10 days later they were gone, and the bear did not destroy the box, so I think they made it.
Oh,
very good.
The most I've ever seen. But anyway, the red-winged blackbirds are, for the first time in 30-some years, coming to my bird feeder. They're not in the marshes anymore. There are no more cattails. They must be drying up out there. And they're a little bit threatening. They perch way up high in the top of a tree, not down low in the marshes like they used to, and they give that warning call, which even scares me because they bombed you when you're on your bicycle once in a while.
Yes.
So your thoughts on them not being in the marshes anymore?
You mentioned that it's dry in your part of the state. Is that right?
Since 2004, we've had droughts most of the years.
Okay. Because I live in eastern Wisconsin, and we've got plenty of rain there, so the wetlands are
great. Yeah.
Okay. And I know out further west of us, also they're in quite a severe drought. So perhaps western Wisconsin isn't getting the rain that we are in the rest of the state. Red-winged blackbirds are early nesters; they're very early arrivals in springtime and tend to nest fairly early. So by this time, the young should be out, and oftentimes they will move beyond the marshes when the nesting duties are over. It's oftentimes a little bit later in the year that you'll see them start to disperse and then start to form the big flocks that get larger and larger as we get into fall. So perhaps the local conditions have moved them out a little bit to look for other food sources. But for the most part, I think the nesting season is done, and whether they are searching for that food right around the nest and within the marsh or in the uplands, I think they're just responding to food availability with the weather conditions you have.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the call, Jerry. Appreciate that. Sandy on Facebook posted a picture of a robin at her Oriole feeder, and she says that he eats the oranges put there. Is that strange? What do you guys think?
Well, birds will do anything, won't they? It certainly isn't the norm.
It isn't the norm.
No, definitely
like
not.
Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, there's always an exception out there, and I think that's what's fun about the people who are calling in here. The unusual things that we see out there.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a downy woodpecker who's trying to get at my hummingbird feeder. Also, nothing that you would expect, but, you know, things can happen.
So do the hummingbirds try to fend the woodpecker?
Well, they just work around him. He struggles to perch and try to both hold on to it and get his face down where the food is. He's tried a few times. I don't think he's that successful, so I've only seen him try it a couple of times. But there again, birds will try anything. There's always an oddball in the crowd, right?
Always. People and birds, yeah,
so
same thing.
I think it's typical of wildlife that a lot of them have a very consistent behavior, and we know them by that. And then there's, you know, that exception to the rule.
Exception to the rule, yeah. Right. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. And we're talking with Bill Volker, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and Tom Schultz, bird artist and illustrator and past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Do you have a question for them? Well, give us a call. Lines are open. Call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Make sure that you stay with us today at 1 o'clock for the Capital Steps Independence Day edition of Politics Takes a Holiday. Because if there's one thing that both sides can agree on, it's that we all could use a laugh. So relax and celebrate your country by helping the Capital Steps make fun of it. That's Politics Takes a Holiday, and that's at 1 o'clock today on the Ideas Network. And I know I look forward to those. They're really fun. And I also look forward to seeing birds out in the area. Now, as birders, what do you look forward to seeing in the summertime? They don't know. There's so much.
I was going to defer to Tom.
I was just going to say for me, summertime is breeding time. And as you probably know, we're right now in the very middle of the 5 years of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And so many of us who are bird watchers now are also paying closer attention to look for nesting evidence of breeding across the entire state. And I especially appreciate the opportunity that the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas affords, because I find myself getting pulled into various corners, different counties and side roads where I probably wouldn't typically go, but because I've been assigned a certain block, I'll go in there and spend more time looking for that sort of evidence for confirmation of breeding. So I enjoy that. And then usually right around early July to mid-July is when some of the early migrants start returning, the sandpipers that are returning from the Arctic tundra where they nested. And so I look forward to viewing a few of those as they're starting to arrive.
Okay. What about you, Bill?
Well, I think of summer as a time when we're watching these birds nesting and the young coming out. So in contrast to spring and fall migration, things are in transit, things are always moving and changing, and it's a time to see both those trends of the arrival of birds in springtime as well as the odd vagrants that get off course and things get mixed up. So now they're settled in, and it's more the expected birds, and I really look forward to seeing the successful nesting. That they're actually rearing the young. They're certainly up here. You're going to try. There's a lot of things working against them naturally and things that we've certainly altered and created some problems for them. So it's always nice to see if birds are successfully rearing their young and adding to those populations and taking advantage of our summer.
Yeah, little miracles all the time. Okay, well, let's go right back to the phones because we have a full house now. Judy in Fort Atkinson, you're next. What's your question?
Yes. First of all, I wanted to say we also have a downy who eats at our hummingbird feeder all the time. He's upside down and drinks out of it all the time. But I'm wondering, we're in the country and we have a lot of trees and we have a lot of different songbirds. But all of a sudden this week we don't seem to have very many anymore. We've got all the food out and they just aren't coming. Are they having their babies? Is that?
Well, summer bird feeding is interesting because first of all, there's just so much natural food out there. They don't need it the way they do in wintertime. It's much easier to track them in winter when the weather's severe. There's a high demand for food and energy, and it's oftentimes harder to find the food out in the wild. So summertime, a couple of cautions with the high temperatures and humidity. You've got to watch a little bit that you don't have the bacteria gathering around the feeder or spoilage of the food. Keep the feeders good and clean. Keep your feeding station clean. But on one hand, there is the opportunity to bring in birds and their youngs, so you may actually attract them to the feeder, which gives you a chance to see them up close. But again, you're competing with so much natural food out there, they don't really need it. It's convenient for them, but there again, when you've got so many other available opportunities for them, they're not hard-pressed for it. So right now, the feeder, leave it out there, keep it clean, but the birds may or may not actually be attracted to it. Nothing you're doing wrong. You're just trying to compete with all that other food out in nature.
Just be patient, mm-hmm. Right? They'll come back. You know, speaking about birds at feeders, I was just curious. It is the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. There are fireworks and loud noises everywhere. What kind of effect does that have on birds in the backyard or birds in the wild? I know it's a controversial topic, maybe. But.
Well, I'm sure it frightens them, mm-hmm. But what are they going to do?
right. Will it keep them away from the birds?
I guess the short answer is they sit there, they freak out for a while, and hope it passes. They'll calm down. So it's probably like any other disturbance. I doubt if it seriously interferes with birds, unless you've got birds that are on the nest in the evening and they abandon overnight for some reason. That it frightens them that much. But otherwise, yeah, it's just an annoyance.
Okay, kind of like with us sometimes, right? So people down the street, they're always making the noise, not us. Okay, let's go back to the phones then. Jim in Coon Valley, what question do you have? Jim, I'm sorry, you're cutting out. I believe that Jim wanted to ask why whippoorwills are declining. Are there any other birds like that that are also ground nesters? Tom, familiar with that?
There are a number of birds that actually nest on the ground, but whippoorwills are definitely in decline. They are birds that are heavily reliant on large flying insects, and we've seen a decline in lots of insect populations over the years, and so that definitely causes a problem for whippoorwills also. I think another cause of problems for them is the increased occurrence of invasive species like buckthorn that
yes.
come in and really fill the understory of some of the woodlots and make it a less desirable place for them to live. I know we formerly used to have lots of whippoorwills around our property. We live in a rural area, and we haven't had them there in probably 20 years, except occasionally one will show up for just a short time. But yeah, they're definitely a big decrease in the numbers of whippoorwills.
And I don't think that there's any one single cause. It seems to be kind of a mystery. It may be a series of factors. They're a tropical migrant, so they're heading way down into the tropics for our winter time. Maybe pressures down there for the birds, as you say, not only available food, maybe contaminants in the food chain. Ground nesting both makes them vulnerable also to predators such as raccoons. We've got plenty of those. So it may be a whole combination of things that are working against the birds. And that's really one of the problems in bird conservation. Whether it's the Breeding Bird Atlas, Breeding Bird Surveys, or other kinds of research and surveys that we do on birds, we first try to determine just how widespread they are and how well they're doing. And if we start to determine some sort of a decline, then the question is, what's the cause and what can we do about it? And that's really a challenge for something like whippoorwill. We haven't been able to put our finger on a single cause, and it may be multiple factors. If we think back at, say, bald eagles, osprey, and peregrine falcons declining because of DDT, that was a real simple fix. Ban DDT, get it out of the food chain, they come back, and they've done extremely well. But for some of these other birds, it may be multiple pressures, and especially for long-distance migrants, it may be here, it may be down south, it may be in between, and it may be all the above. So that really makes it much more challenging to try to figure out what really is the biggest thing working against them and what can we change to try to help them recover. And for whippoorwills, it's still a bit of a mystery as to what is the biggest impact. But yeah, definitely, as Tom said, they have been declining. I also had them 20-some years ago in the neighborhood, and we just don't hear them anymore. So
yeah.
That's sad.
We've had a lot of listeners say the same thing. So, well, thank you for bringing that up, Jim, and sorry we couldn't get to you to actually talk on air, but we appreciate the call. Let's go next to Mike in Lake Mills. Hi, Mike. What's your question?
Good morning. One observation, one question.
Go right ahead.
First, the observation, I was on my bike the other day and went by, and I saw a hawk taking like a bird bath in an old abandoned dwelling. Sort of a basement. Just really weird. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-hmm. Hey, everybody's got to wash up sometime.
Of course, I didn't have my phone with me, so I couldn't take a picture.
Of course.
My question, though, is we've had a wonderful collection of Baltimore Orioles this year. They were going nuts over the jelly and the orange, and my wife is worried that the jelly isn't good for them. And the second question is, now they've just sort of disappeared the last couple of days, and the same thing happened last year. And is that something they do each summer, just sort of come until July and then head out into the fields?
Yes, this is not unusual for orioles. They tend to be one of our earlier migrants, I think. Once they've finished nesting, they typically only have a single clutch of babies. And once the babies are out of the nest, they start roaming around and covering more ground and gradually working their way southward. So it's not a big surprise that you're not seeing nearly as many in July and into August. Sometimes they'll hang around the feeders, but it becomes much less frequent than it was earlier in the season.
Well, as you say, if they're nesting right near your house, the food's very available. They're tied to that nest, so you're going to see them on a pretty regular basis. But now the young are out. They're not ready to migrate or leave yet, but they are dispersing. They're moving around. The other thing I find with orioles is they're a real treetop bird. And so when the leaves are full, unless they're really vocal or flying out in the open, you may not know they're up there. And this time of year, since they're past that nesting season, may just be the begging calls of the young. They're not calling as much. Mm-hmm. So they may be even hiding overhead, just not as vocal or as visible as they might have been when they're tied to the nest and looking for food on a regular basis.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that call, Mike. Next up is Scott in Eau Claire. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I just have a question. We've noticed some odd behavior of birds. We have a branch by our bird bath, and usually after they drink, they'll go up and they'll wipe their beaks on the branches, kind of like we would wipe our mouth with a napkin after we're done eating. And I also noticed a goldfinch land one day, and he wiped his beak before he drank. I just wondered why they did it. It's the first kind of the first year we actually noticed it before, and we've always had the bird bath in the same spot and everything.
We'll chalk it up to good manners. Well, birds, the beak has to do everything. So in other words, the forelimbs, where, you know, for mammals, you've got paws and hands and so forth. They oftentimes can manipulate food. Everything is done with the beak because, you know, they've devoted that to flight. And so there's a little bit of that beak maintenance. There may be food that gets stained along the edge of the beak. So as you say, your goldfinch maybe cleaned himself off after he had eaten something and then a good slug of water to wash it down. Nobody likes to be a slob. So, you know, this is a little bit of that just general maintenance and care. And as I say, the beak's got to do everything for them, so they've got to keep that in good shape and keep it clean.
Okay. Well, thank you for that call, Scott. We've got Darlene in Duluth calling. Darlene, what can we help you with?
Well, I was kind of wondering about the pileated woodpecker. I have a pair of them that come to my feeder occasionally, but I never hear the sound they make. But sometimes during the summer, if I'm outside, I can hear this horrible racket. It sounds like a witch cackling or something, and I was just wondering if that's their call or if they don't have a call.
Well, I see you want someone to imitate it. I'm going to leave that to Tom. I think he does a really good.
Thanks, Bill. Well, I can give it a try, but it's a very loud call, like you say, and typically, they wouldn't probably do it near the feeders, but you'd hear them calling from out in the woods.
It reminds me of a flicker, but much more robust.
Yeah.
Much greater intensity. So, yeah, they really belt out a good call. If you're looking for a reference for that, I would suggest to go to the Cornell website, All About Birds.
Yes.
Go there, just do a search under pileated, and you'll find in there a variety of different calls.
And so that's where I usually get the ones mm-hmm. that we do on the program. In fact, I've got a yellow-bellied sapsucker, so maybe we could hear that right now.
Oh, sure.
I wanted to get that drumming at the end. So is that anything? I mean, sapsuckers, woodpeckers are kind of...
Sapsucker is a woodpecker.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It is a member of the woodpecker family. Mm-hmm. And most woodpeckers are not all that vocal. They all make some sort of a sound, but the vast majority don't really make a song. That's why they do the drumming.
Mm-hmm. Which we heard at the end, which was
right.
That, yeah.
And the unusual thing for the sapsucker is this intermittent or interrupted tapping. To me, it sounds like Morse code. So it's not like this fast rattle that you hear out of the downy or hairy woodpeckers when they're tapping on trees. But that irregular little tap, little pauses and on and off. The sapsucker tends to nest in western Wisconsin and throughout northern Wisconsin. They're pretty widespread. During migration, they can show up almost anywhere. And you'll certainly see them on a number of trees in springtime, tapping those little sap wells. That's where they got the name from.
Ah.
And I live in the northern Kettle Moraine area in east central Wisconsin. And for the last 3-4 years now, I've had sapsuckers nesting right in my backyard. And that is actually a sort of a new area for them.
Okay.
So and what you heard there was a lot of vocalization between more than one bird. I've got them right now feeding young in a cavity, and they can oftentimes be quite vocal when a young are begging for food.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
I like that. Let's go back to the phones. Up next, we have Mary in La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hi. This is a Baltimore or an Oriole question also. Yesterday, I was at a friend's house. They had to cut down a tree, and it had the hanging nest on it, and so she kept it, and we were looking at it, and the opening to the nest is so small, and we wondered how in the world the female laid the eggs and how she would hatch them, and then how in the world she would take care of them. And the other question is, I assume that nest hangs a long time, and do they use that every year, or is that a one-time nest?
Great questions, Mary. Gentlemen?
Yes, definitely. They build a sock-like nest. Probably many people have seen them, usually out in the outer branches of a large tree. And the opening is typically in the top of the sock, you know, that they go down into to feed the young. So I never quite think of that as a tiny opening. I'm not sure where that came from, but maybe there was an opening in the side, a hole in the side for some reason.
Well, it is kind of a bulbous nest, and I suppose maybe they wove it a little tight right by the entrance. They squeezed through, but you've got plenty of room inside for her to move around. They always have to roll the eggs because you've got to keep that embryo floating in there and get the heat on different sides.
Oh.
So they have to have a little bit of room to manipulate that and for her to actually then incubate and get the body heat on the eggs.
Okay.
As Tom said, they tend to build them way out on the end of the branches, and with such heavy foliage, we usually don't notice them until we get into fall or winter. She also asked if they use it again. No, they rebuild a nest every year. And that's also part of not just good nest maintenance and construction, but part of the pair bonding that the two adults are bringing that nest material together, sort of agree on a nest site and establish themselves as a mated pair.
Mm-hmm. Now, I had a robin that had a nest last year, and then this year nobody used it until just a little while ago, and I think it was another bird came, rebuilt it, mm-hmm. and had another. I mean, is that kind of typical that they reuse a nest that's already there?
Well, they may build on top of it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And especially for birds that are territorial, coming back to the same area is always possible. And we see this among a number of birds that are a little bit more long-lived and home back in on the same nesting site. If they're successful in one place one year, they'll come right back there. Hey, it worked.
That makes sense.
We notice this with Canada geese, for example, and even ducks, that they oftentimes return right back to their natal ground to nest right nearby. But if they have a nest failure, they'll oftentimes then look for a different site, and even among birds like geese that we know mate for life, in that early nesting attempt for the young birds that are just beginning to nest, they may even switch and find a different mate. I'll blame somebody else for the problems. It wasn't the predators. So mating for life for those birds is the trend, but there is what I've always referred to as a slight proportion of divorce rate among the population.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question. Now, Tessa in Bayfield emailed us, and she says it's quite a few years since they have seen any golden-crowned kinglets in their fir trees. Do you have any information on how they're doing?
I think, like a lot of the northern forest birds, they're in at least a slight decline. But the kinglets are something that you can easily miss during the migration period. It's a tiny little bird, probably not much larger than a hummingbird, really.
Those guys make chickadees look big.
Yeah, they're very tiny, and they can be confiding. Sometimes you see them quite close, but I know personally, I don't always see big numbers of them every year. Sometimes I'm lucky to see one or two. But they're like a lot of the forest birds that are insectivorous, they're in somewhat of a decline. And like Bill said before, some of that may be due to their wintering grounds or migration areas, that they're in some trouble in those places also.
Okay. Let's go to Dave in Fond du Lac. Hi, Dave. What question do you have?
Hi there. I'm wondering if my finches are getting food. I have a population of finches hitting the finch feeders. I have a variety of them, a couple of them expensive ones that I bought at reputable bird places, and a couple of them that I bought at cheapos that are not from those kind of stores. And the seed just doesn't seem to be going down. And any of them. The only one that I really do replace the seed a lot in is those bag feeders for finches. I'm wondering if they're just not getting the seed, or if I've got more feed.
What do you guys think?
Are you filling all those feeders out of the same bag of seed?
Yes.
Okay, the only reason I ask is because Niger seed, or the, what's been called thistle seed, we know that that can spoil fairly easily. And if you've got a thistle feeder out there that just is not getting hit by the birds, it's probably old seed. And best thing then is just dump it out, get something else, and start over again. And the general recommendation is try to go to a store that keeps a good supply of bird seed and a pretty good turnover in the inventory. You don't want to pick it up, say, at like a hardware store where they've got just a small shelf and they're selling a lot of tools and other things, but only a bag of the seed every couple of months. It may be sitting there and getting old. So that we do know it can spoil. And I've had problems with that where I've just noticed that all of a sudden the feeder, it's been full for weeks, and I know the finches are around. So I just change the inventory. Otherwise, I don't know. Any other explanation?
That's the only one I can think of. I find that birds aren't real particular about the type of feeder as long as they can get at the seed.
Right.
So,
and finches, the goldfinches this time of year, they'll feed throughout the summertime, so it does attract them, especially as they're waiting for the thistle seed to ripen yet.
All right. Well, Dave, try some new seed. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. And we're talking with Bill Volkart, who's a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and Tom Schultz. He's a bird artist and illustrator and past president of the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology. Do you have a question for them? Because we have four lines open just waiting for you to give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email, and that address is ideas@wpr.org. Well, tomorrow at 11 o'clock, wildlife expert Scott Craven is going to be with us to talk about the effect that all of our rain has had on wildlife this year. We're also going to talk about the high number of garden pests and some spring wildlife survey results. Hope you can join us for that. We're talking about wildlife today, but we're talking about birds. And we're going to go right straight to the phone, gentlemen. We've got Mike from Appleton, and he has something for us. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What do you have for us today?
I was traveling on Highway 41 this week between Green Bay and Kaukauna, and along the frontage road there was a snowy owl or an Arctic owl flying just above the ground, obviously about hunting mice, I would think. But I was just shocked to see a snowy owl this time of year. At first I thought it was like a plastic white bag blowing along in the ditch, but it was an owl, and it was full sized. It was an adult. It was very large, and he eventually pounced on whatever he was chasing and covered it, of course, with his wings, and then began eating. But I was just shocked and surprised to see something in this area. I thought, you know, it seemed out of the ordinary.
Is it?
Definitely.
Pretty unusual to see a snowy owl in the summertime. You know, we think of them as being pure white or nearly pure white and very protectively colored in the snowfields where they would typically be seen. But occasionally you get a few birds that linger behind and for whatever reason don't migrate back to the Arctic when it's time in the spring, and they stick around. But I know this year there was one seen in southern Green Lake County in early June, and then might have been the same bird that moved over to the Fond du Lac area shortly after that. And who knows, this could be the same individual that has gone a little further north now. But they're fun to see no matter what time of year, but they're certainly more conspicuous now in the landscape.
I was going to say, definitely stand out.
Yeah, I saw the posting of that sighting a couple of weeks ago, which is certainly the exception to the rule. It's an Arctic nester, and their primary food tends to be lemmings in the Arctic. So when that rodent population is abundant, they both have very large numbers of young, and they tend to stay up there even through the Arctic winter. But occasionally they'll move down into the northern states. So, as Tom said, we'll see them in the wintertime, and all of them should have gotten the memo to head north for the summer. Whether this was a bird that was in poor condition and didn't linger, or who knows what, something there did not signal it for to head back north. And, yeah, very unusual sighting.
Just likes Wisconsin summers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for calling in about that, Mike. Next up is Julie in La Crosse. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I have a mourning dove who's nesting on top of a pillar right by my front porch, and it's right underneath the soffit. And I love to have mourning doves and birds nest around my house, but unfortunately, this is her second. I thought it was her third, but apparently they only brood two times or have two.
No, they may have three down in the southern states. They may have as many as five broods.
Well, it seems to me like this is her third one because mm-hmm. I was going to take that nest down when she was done with the last brood. And because I'm having painting done next week, and I've been a little bit nervous about going up there and shooing her away off mm-hmm. of her nest, and I'm wondering if it's possible for me to take her nest safely down and place it in the tree, which is close by.
You can try that, but yeah, it may interfere with her nesting, especially since she's had more than one brood already successful from that nest. Usually birds will tolerate some disturbance very early in the nesting season. So when they first arrive here, find a mate, and are starting to set up a nest, say if you've got the robin right by the front porch where people are always coming and going, and that gets to be an annoyance. You can do something then very early on. There's more than enough time. They'll just find an alternative site and settle in. Now we're pretty well into that summer nesting season with a couple of successful nests. You could try to move that, but she may just abandon. I guess the good news is, well, you probably can't put up your painting on one hand, but she's already pulled off two families. So well, not much else I could offer for advice, I guess.
Yes. Just try, and hopefully that'll work. We had a posting on Facebook from Lisa, and she wanted to know, do Phoebes have more than one brood in one season? And we happen to have a sound effect from that particular bird, so let's listen to that real quick. So, do they have more than one brood in a season?
They can.
Okay.
Phoebes are flycatchers, so they're in that family of birds. It tends to be an earlier migrant than most other flycatchers, so they may start their nesting a little sooner. The general trend is probably most of them only have one brood, but it's not unusual for Phoebe to have a second brood. Also, for those who are not familiar with the call, you can tell where it got its name. So that's a very easy, very diagnostic call for it. They also tend to nest on ledges. So they'll build a little moss nest, usually on a sheltered ledge, under a bridge. I've got them under my deck. There's a nice little ledge that they can nest on. People also have done Phoebe platforms, so you don't have to have a cup, just something flat with a little shelter over the top up near the eaves of the house. They tend to nest very commonly. I also see them quite a bit on some of the larger trailhead signs on our state parks and places where you've got signs on both sides with a little roof over the top.
Yep, I know what you're talking about.
Not unusual to walk up to the sign and see one of the Phoebes come flying out from the side.
What a perfect spot.
Yeah, so that's a typical type of nesting site for them.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you. And thanks for that question. Let's go back to the phones. Next up, we have Neil in Slinger. Hi, Neil.
Hi. I got two questions. The first one is, I counted on the wire to my big shed, and I used to leave the door open because I counted 60 about 10 years ago. Now I only had two, and they didn't stay in the shed. Also, I saw three great big birds. It was about time the lilacs bloomed, but the leaves weren't all out, in a tree by the house, and they had hooked beaks like eagles, but they were all dark.
Hmm.
Two questions.
Okay, well, let's take the first one with the swallows. I'm assuming are those barn swallows, Neil?
Did they get knocked out in their migration?
Okay, I'm sorry we missed that first part, but well, let's go to the swallow question first. Are those barn swallows you're talking about?
Sounds like it would be barn swallows
if
they were nesting
swallows.
In the shed.
Okay.
It used to be 60. I counted about 10 years ago, 60 on the wire. Mm-hmm. And cutting grass, they were diving all around me for insects. And this year, it dropped down year after year. Now there were only two here. and they took it off some other place.
Okay, what's going on there, do you think?
I wonder if there's been any change where you formerly had animals on the property, cattle or sheep or something like that.
No, nothing like that.
No, because I know we formerly had sheep at our house and used to have always have barn swallows nesting in that shed. And then once the sheep left, it seemed like, I don't know, maybe they were attracting insects, flying insects that attracted the swallows, but they haven't been back much since. So now we have a phoebe that's built a nest on top of one of the barn swallow nests. So we at least have those inside of the shed.
Recycling. Any ideas on that?
Well, there is a bit of a concern over some of our swallow populations. They're insectivores, aerial mm-hmm. feeders, so they're chasing the insects, catching them out of the air. And maybe there's been some thought of perhaps contaminants getting into that food chain, and it may not even be up here. But some of the regulations and usage of that as we go further south in different countries, that may be some contaminants there. And barn swallows are very long-distance migrants.
Are they?
Unlike most birds that will pick up and fly to the winter ground in a couple of weeks and then settle in there and just establish a territory somewhere in, say, Mexico or Central America or Northern South America, barn swallows, because they feed on the wing, they just follow that food source down. So they may hang around Central America throughout the wintertime. They may pass through there. I've actually seen them all the way down in Argentina. So they just sort of drift the whole winter, just going down, following the food, and slowly drift back up with the food. Well, that could expose them to different contaminants in that food chain. As Tom says, it may be something very localized, too, though, for that particular population.
Okay.
So not certain.
Go ahead.
On the large birds that he's talking about, thing that comes to my mind would be turkey vultures.
Yeah, possibly. I also wondered about immature eagles,
we've got those nesting almost statewide now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they don't breed until they're about 4 or 5 years of age.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So the younger birds would be quite dark.
And they stay dark for quite that whole time?
Yeah, they don't get the white head, as Tom says, until they're 4 or 5 years old or so. And so there's these immature plumages that are very dark, and then it becomes speckled and eventually get the adult plumage.
All right. Well, that's something to think about, Neil. Maybe you can find some pictures of those and see if that's what you were looking at. Let's go to Ellen in Waupun. Hi, Ellen. What's going on with you?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. We have had a hawk in our backyard this year, a small one, and I think it's a sharp-shinned hawk, but it's just being a nuisance bird, and I'm just concerned that he will be returning in another year. Is that how it works?
Well, if they're nesting in the area, they may come back again to nest there the following year. Do you have bird feeders up around your house?
Yes, and they have. We've had almost no birds on the bird feeders this year.
These birds also will hit the bird feeders as we get into wintertime. And you have what I always refer to as a two-stage feeding tier there, where the songbirds come in for the food and then this bird seed, and then of course the hawks will come in for the songbirds. And it's usually the sharp shin and coopers that tend to hunt those. You may want to consider just shutting down your feeders for a little bit, see if the birds don't disperse a little bit more, that you're not luring them right in and kind of setting them up as food for the hawk. And if he is nesting nearby, hopefully it's about that time where they're the young are fledging and they should be dispersing. And that's always the hint for wintertime, too. If you've got a bird feeder that the hawks are taking advantage of, stop feeding for a little while. The birds will disperse. He'll move on, and then you can resume again. See if that doesn't work for you.
Okay, well, good luck, Ellen. And just a few minutes before we take a break for news, but Bill, you brought in some information about these birds in Nicaragua, because you go down there quite often, and and you do tours. What are they like? What is it like to go down there in February and see all these birds? Just a few minutes to describe it us.
Well, February is my favorite month to go because it is the driest month in Nicaragua. And it's also, I think, a great time to get away from Wisconsin. Winter's always nice, but it can get old.
For so long.
So February, yeah. And so February is about the time where people get cabin fever. And the other nice thing is that you not only get a chance to get down into the tropics to see all the resident exotic birds, but ours are down there.
Right.
So you'll see the orioles and the rose-breasted grosbeaks and warblers the other half of their life. So, yes, I've been working in Nicaragua for about 15 years now on a variety of different conservation and wildlife education projects. And a few years ago, to help them with their ecotourism, which they're certainly envious of what Costa Rica's achieved.
Right.
We wanted to do something for bird watchers. I knew the people who are working on a field guide for the identification of the birds in the country, but I published a book on where to watch birds. So once you know what may live there, so where do you go? How do you get there? And so I helped them out with that. And once the book came out, I decided to kick it off and take a group down as a tour. It was so successful. We had such a good time. We've run several tours since. And this coming February, I actually have two tours, because I know not everybody's a diehard bird watcher, which for Tom and I guess is hard to believe.
But
there are those people. So anyway, yes, in February we'll have two tours. Just go to my website, billvolkert.com. Full details and itinerary are there, and people can just check it out there.
Well, it sounds like a good time. I think you should take me with you so I can report. How does that sound?
Okay. You're invited.
Our guests are Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and Tom Schultz, bird artist and illustrator, and past president of the Wisconsin Ornithology, Society of Ornithology. Sorry, got that right. We are going to be going to the news, and we'll be back right after that. Talking about birds today. Hi, Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for sharing your holiday with us. We're happy to have Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz back with us. Bill is a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, and he worked at Horicon Marsh for, 27 years, and he's been watching birds for well over 40. And Tom is a bird artist and illustrator and has illustrated a number of field guides, including several editions of the National Geographic's Field Guide to the Birds of North America. Do you feed the birds during the summer? Well, who's coming to your feeder? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And of course, you can also post to our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show, and we have some wonderful photos, as we always do. And this time we have a photo of an egg rather than a bird. It's Patricia, and she was wondering if you guys could identify this egg she found in her backyard in Milwaukee. Have you figured out what it is yet?
Yeah, I happened to bring a book along, Peterson Field Guide to Bird Nests.
Okay.
I thought it looked like a cardinal, and looking at the picture in the book, I think that's probably what
okay.
It could be.
All right. Well, that makes sense.
Now, based on the size and the coloration, yeah.
Sure.
That's our best guess.
Yeah, and we got another picture from Jody, and she was wondering how often herons land on the top of trees. And she's got a really nice picture of a bird coming in there's a bird coming in from a landing in the front, and there's a heron in the background sitting right on the top of the tree. She's seen that a couple of times. Is that pretty normal?
It's not unusual. The great blue heron is a very tall bird.
They're huge.
But they only weigh about 3 to 5 pounds.
Oh, really?
It's an awful lot of wing and feathers,
yeah. But
there's not much weight to the bird.
Okay.
And they also nest high in trees. And they're a colonial nester, so they're not going to find them singly, but in large colonies. And they'll pack those nests into the middle and upper parts of trees. And yeah, not unusual at all for them to perch way up on top like that.
Well, that's interesting you say they're colonial, because I've only seen a blue heron in by itself. Only so they must fly for quite far distances then.
Well, they normally don't nest until they're at least 2 years old.
Oh.
So you may have early in spring birds that are wandering, and some of the young that may be just coming into the nesting are moving around. Then they'll move very quickly into those nesting colonies, and we saw at Horicon where we had a very large colony, some of those birds go right to the site before you even know that they're around, and then they'll start feeding around on the marsh. Well, those are the older adults that are trying to get into that nesting season as fast as possible. That also means that there's a lot of floaters out there of the young birds that aren't yet ready to nest. And as we get into the end of June, early July, this is when the young are out. So now they'll start to disperse. They're no longer tied just to that nest site. And what we find is that herons will fly on average 12 to 15 miles to look for food. They may be feeding much closer to the nest site, but they'll range about that far. Once you get to midsummer, they'll disperse all over the state.
And they dispersed into my pond and ate my goldfish. But we won't go there. Let's go back to the phones. We have Kathy in Verona waiting to ask us a question. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, we have about 5.5 acres with, I don't know how much is, you know, field with pathways and tall grasses and such. We have about 6 bluebird nesting boxes set up. And we've had great luck the last 2 years that we've been here. This year, we have had, we found 1 dead male bluebird in a box, which we believe perhaps a sparrow or something had pecked his head. Then there was a nest with 5 eggs. Only 2 of them hatched, and they basically seemed like failure to thrive. It's like they got a certain age, and then they passed away, because we do go around and check the boxes to make sure that, you know, a sparrow hasn't gotten in there, or, you know, that they're doing okay. Now we've had a clutch of tree swallows and a clutch of bluebirds that also the same thing. They had their eggs. They seem to be doing okay. And I'll check on them periodically, like every couple days. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, am I checking on them too much? Because they look like teenage adolescent birds that are just about ready to fledge or whatever you call it. And then I look and I'm like, oh my God, they're dead. So I'm wondering what might be going on.
Well, it's hard to know for sure. A couple of possibilities come to my mind. One is that it's possible, as you said, you found a dead adult, and occasionally that happens. And if something would happen to one or both of the adults, and certainly the young birds would starve in the nest. There'd be nobody there to take care of them. I don't know if that's a possibility in your situation, but also I wonder about insect populations in your local area, if they've perhaps been affected by spraying pesticides somewhere in the area, and it knocked the numbers down, so they weren't finding enough to feed the young birds. It's hard to know exactly what's
if you've got
there.
Dead young or adults in the nest box, usually pecked on the head by either house sparrows or house wren is another possibility, particularly pipping the eggs earlier on. Mm-hmm. So maybe some predation there, or from competition trying to reduce that. But yeah, it's always a little guesswork.
Okay. Yeah, hard to know. But house sparrows can be very aggressive and can actually enter the nest and kill nestlings or even adults sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I wanted to talk something. Carol emailed us, and she asked, and we've had this before. We've heard mm-hmm. rumors. Is grape jelly actually good or bad for Orioles? You want to weigh in, gentlemen?
I wouldn't say it's bad for them. I guess I'd look at it like hamburgers. If you're going to live on them exclusively, it's probably not the best food. But hey, you know, every once in a while, it's not going to kill you. They obviously enjoy it. They're going for it. But it's not going to round out the whole diet. But like a lot of these birds, even the hummingbirds, they get the protein from insects. So they're eating a lot of other food as well. So I've never heard anything that you should stop feeding them grape jelly. It's actually become incredibly popular, and I know people who look for these really large jars of
yes.
the cheap stuff because they're like killing their food budget. So you can go through an awful lot of it, but I've never heard any warnings about it.
No, I sort of think of it as like many people have a sweet tooth.
Yeah,
people like candy or other types of sweets, donuts perhaps. It's not the best thing you can eat, but If you don't make a steady diet of it, it's yeah. probably not going to hurt you to, mm-hmm. to have a little once in a while. And I know a lot of people put out jelly and oranges, especially earlier in the season when they first come back mm-hmm. from migration, and there aren't probably a lot of insects out yet, mm-hmm. caterpillars and so forth, that they would normally eat. So that sort of supplements their diet for a while.
Little calories mm-hmm. here and there.
Yes.
Now, you had mentioned hummingbirds, too, and I've heard a lot about, you know, colored nectar in the hummingbird feeders as opposed to not being good, and you should have clear.
There's no need to add a food coloring to mm-hmm. it. Simply a 4-to-1 mixture of water and sugar. Good enough, just do that, put it out there.
I've seen reports where the actual color can do harm to the hummingbirds. Have you heard that?
Well, it's not necessary. We don't know what's in those food colorings, maybe different kinds of food colorings that are out there. It doesn't do anything to attract the birds.
So don't do it.
Yeah, just don't even bother with it. And, you know, you've got an extremely tiny bird with an incredibly high metabolism. So I suppose if you run enough of something through a little bird like that, it may not be healthy for them. So, yeah, just sugar and water is good enough.
Okay. Well, you got it from the experts, people. That's
I also
it.
See another message here about hummingbirds. Filling up a feeder overnight.
Yeah, let's go to Lynn in Hustisford, and we can talk to her about that.
Okay.
Lynn, what's going on with your hummingbird feeder?
Well, I've had it out for about a week, and it's slowly been going down. And last night when I closed the curtains, it was about half full at the most. Well, no, it's more than half full. This morning when I opened the curtains, it was completely empty. Can they empty it overnight, or did something else get it?
Something else. They don't drink at night. They're sleeping at that time. I actually had the very same problem with mine, which is why this was interesting to me. I just had to move the hummingbird feeder a little farther out on a branch. Whether it was squirrels or raccoon in the evening, I was trying to get at it. If you start tipping the hummingbird feeder, you'll notice it's when you're hanging it up. If it tips a little bit, it'll start just running out of there. So if a larger mammal is trying to get at it and that thing's swinging back and forth, they can drain it pretty quickly. So no, you've got some other problem. Try to find a little different location for it where maybe it's a little less accessible to some mammals.
Well, my dad up in the UP had a deer coming to his, tipping it over, and yeah, it was quite interesting because it was really close to the house, but yeah, it really liked.
Deer with a sweet tooth.
The
okay.
deer loved it. The deer loved it. So, all right, well, Lynn, hopefully you can move that and keep the hummingbird food for the hummingbirds. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. What's going on?
Well, I'm in central Milwaukee, you know, in a regular neighborhood with cars and trees and all that kind of thing. And in May, in our music room area, there's a bunch of windows, you know, about 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. And a goldfinch has been coming to the edge of one of these windows, and he can hardly hang on to the windowsill. And he bangs his bill on that thing for an hour or so. And there was another female bird around, too, for a while. Well, we thought this is unusual. He's trying to get in maybe the reflection. But he comes back. He came back almost every day for 3 weeks. And now he was gone. And the other day, here he is again, pounding on the window.
Is he a percussionist? This is a music room, right?
Good thought. I call it shadow boxing. He's seeing his reflection. And the main birds that we see doing this are goldfinches, cardinals, and robins. Brightly colored birds, very common around the homes. And they see the reflection, thinks it's a competitor. You've got to try to break them of that habit very early on or put some sort of distraction up. I've had them do that too, try to cover some way or have some flyers and things out there, little things that move around in the wind. He just moved to the next window. I also had them doing the same thing for the outside mirrors on a car. And you'll see the droppings just all over down the doors and around the mirror itself. So what happens is it seems to be an individual behavior. They don't all do it, but every once in a while you get one who just gets fixated on this, wants to get rid of the competitor. And every time he goes to that window, gosh, there he is. He flutters and tries to chase him away. It's like, okay, I was successful. Turns around, darn, he's back again. So, yeah, they get into this almost neurotic behavior. It can be hard to break them of the habit, but the sooner that they start doing it that you can deter them, the better off you are. Otherwise, it'll go on for a little while till you get toward that mid-summer where you get to the end of the nesting season. He'll eventually get over it, but he may be back next year.
Oh, yay. Something to look forward to.
One thing that I've found that works sometimes to cut down on the reflection by putting a sheet of white paper or something up against the glass, and that'll reduce that that mirror effect. And then they won't
that
be attacking that same window anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I will say, I've given enough of this advice over the radio in the past, and it sounds so easy. I've tried all kinds of things with one bird I had, and he just went to the next window and the next one. I had streamers and all kinds of things on my window, and you know, people come by and go, Philip, but you're the bird expert. I go, this guy doesn't learn. So it may be challenging.
The bird
but good
didn't
luck.
Know that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So good luck with it. Maybe okay. Hard to break them, unfortunately.
Well, you know, we get pictures all the time, but we actually had a listener that sent us a recording of a bird. It was Barb on Lake Wissota in Chippewa Falls, and she said it sings every morning, but she's never seen it, and she says, could the bird guys identify it for us? So we had listened to it earlier, and I know we were trying to get it onto the AV, but I don't know if it's come up yet. Getting a message from Brianna, our on-air producer, to see if that's the case. But, gentlemen, you got a chance to hear it. Could you solve that little mystery for her?
Yeah, it was a typical song of a song sparrow.
Okay.
That's one of the more common sparrows that lives in Wisconsin and nests pretty much statewide.
Oh, there we go. Oh. We got it. Nope, just a little bit. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. There we go. And we've probably heard that one before.
Yeah, as Tom said, very widespread. Mm-hmm. I recognize it by the pattern. A couple of introductory notes, a little trill in the middle, and then just sort of trails off at the end. A lot of variation to the individuals, and even among an individual might try a couple of different song types, but there's always that pattern to it, and that's why it's referred to as Song Sparrow. He's got a really nice, well-recognized song, but he likes to hide in the bushes, so that's why maybe it's not always a bird that's easy to see, but very easily heard.
Well, we're talking with Bill Volkert, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and Tom Schultz, bird artist and illustrator and past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. We're talking about birds, if you haven't gathered that by that last sound. But we have a couple of lines open, so if you have a question for either of these gentlemen, please give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. And we're going to go to Barbie in Green Bay. Hi, Barbie. What's on your mind today?
Hi guys.
Hi.
We have a woodpecker, and I put question mark. To me, he's very unusual. I live in an apartment, and he likes to peck on the metal drain spouts on the building, and it sounds like a mini machine gun. And so we've sort of given him the name Pipey, the pipe pecker, but. Is this something that woodpeckers do? I mean, the word wood is in there. Why a metal pipe?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, Bill mentioned that woodpeckers don't have a song as such. So their song is really the drumming that they do. Obviously, they peck on trees to also obtain food and dig nest holes. But they have this distinctive drumming that they do. And usually they look for a resonant log, branch, or whatever to hammer on that really broadcasts the sound. But occasionally they will hammer on something metal, like a downspout or an eaves trough. Actually, you're lucky if that's all they're hammering on, because some people have lots of trouble with woodpeckers drilling holes into their siding, wooden siding, and creating real mess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've heard some mailboxes also are a good target for those woodpeckers. Okay, well, Barbie, now you can believe your husband that is a woodpecker. And let's go to Ann in Monona. Hi, Ann.
Hi, I wondered whether there were any studies that showed that birds of any species were affected by genetic engineering of plants, whether the taste is different. I know I can taste a difference, and I wondered, since birds are more sensitive, whether they might be able to, too.
That's an interesting question. I don't know if there actually have been any studies done, or if the genetically modified foods have been around long enough that anybody's really bothered to look at it. But I would also think that perhaps most of the crops that we are doing some tweaking with in the genetics are probably not things that birds eat on that regularly.
Would that affect the insects, though?
Well, there's a possibility that, obviously some of the genetic engineering is to try to reduce the insect pests. And we also know from studies that have been done on the invasive non-native plants that those plants don't produce the nutrients that our native insects really need. So as we get more invasives getting into a field or a woodlot, insect populations oftentimes go down because it just isn't healthy for them. Well, as a consequence, you just don't have the food base for the songbirds then. Okay. So there may be that kind of chain reaction. But directly genetically engineered plants, whether that's in any way impacting birds, I don't know if anybody's really looked at that. Nothing I know of.
I don't either. I have heard of no studies at all.
No.
Well, I would imagine somebody's thinking about it. So let us know if that's something that you're thinking of studying. Thank you for that interesting question, Anne. Let's go to Carol in Manitowoc. Hi, Carol. What's your question?
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have never been successful getting screech owls to be in our screech box. But interestingly, this spring, we had a bird show up living in there that we can't find on our, in our bird books. And it seems to be olive with a black eye, a creamy round belly, at least one of them does. But they have long tail feathers like a cardinal with amber, they seem from a distance, with amber-colored tail feathers.
Well, Carol, we have big smiles here in the studio. I think they know what it is. Go ahead,
I think we're probably pretty safe in naming that a great-crested flycatcher.
Ooh.
They are a cavity-nesting bird. They'll nest in boxes or woodpecker holes in trees. I don't think they're real particular about the nest site. One of the characteristics is they often take a piece of snake skin and carry it into their nest hole. Sometimes it hangs out of the nest hole. I don't know if you've seen that or not, and that may be a...
From a recent shedding.
Right, yeah. Recently shed snake skins.
Why?
Right.
What's it for, decoration?
Well, some people have postulated maybe to deter predators,
okay.
To scare them, but nobody really knows for sure. Uh-huh. That's also kind of a mystery.
I've seen pictures like that. I was curious.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that sounds like a pretty neat bird. Is it relatively unusual?
It's a forest bird.
Okay.
It is a true tropical migrant. So they're down in Central America the other half of the year. Mm-hmm. Most of our flycatchers, not a real varied song, but a real distinctive reep, reep.
Okay. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes here. So why don't you, people are always asking us to identify birds when you're on here. Do you have some really good resources that people can, refer to, either maybe on the internet, apps, or books?
I'm sure Tom will promote his book.
I'm sure, as he should.
There's an awful lot of material out there. The apps probably have a little bit of limitations. You need to have your connection for one, and I find sometimes the screens are hard to see in bright daylight.
True.
So you can carry a lot of information that way or access it, but to me, I still like a good book. And I've always found that the book that just works best for you, just thumb through it, and something that you can relate to that looks like those birds that you know. Everybody has a little bit of a different interpretation and illustrations and so forth. So, I think it's just something that works well for you. And just take
real
a look.
Quick, Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, we're in a great time now when there's a great wealth of field guides available, and you can find pretty much a real nice type that will suit your needs.
Okay. Well, Bill, thank you very much for being with us again. And Tom, we really appreciate you being with us again also. I'd like to say thanks to Brianne Sashout for on-air production and to Dave Potras for technical direction. Make sure you join us tomorrow at 11 when Scott Craven's going to be back with us and we're going to talk about wildlife with him. I'm Jill Nadeau sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Wish you a safe and happy Independence Day. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us. There's always more to come.